League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Yeah, it's a bit of a... This is not a normal podcast.
No, it isn't.
That sounds like quite good. This is not a normal podcast. Yeah, so this is... It's weird, first of all, because I've got... So I've got Emily on the other side. Emily, big boss at Atticus. She's bigger than Jimmy, so she's a big boss. Jimmy will probably agree, actually, now I think about it.
He's literally on the other side of the desk and nodding, I'm sure.
So we're... We thought it would be basically, so Emily's previous life was in journalism. So we were chatting the other day, and between the pair of us, we thought it'd be really useful to do a podcast episode talking about 107 TDF, kind of getting some of the questions that I've been asked, because I've been inundated with questions. I literally haven't been able to keep up with the messages that it's been like, do you know what? Kind of a positive of being made redundant is that I can respond to as much of it as I can. But it's been, it's been tricky to keep on top of all of that side of it. There's been a lot of, a hell of a lot of support, which is incredible. It's really incredible. It's very heartwarming to get that from all over the world. Anyway, so there's been a lot of questions of people asking about it. So Emily sort of said to me, let's work out about doing like an FAQ page or something on the website, and to which I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. And I was like, no, actually, let's just do it as a podcast because it's easier.
That's true. It probably is easier just to sort of spout out a load of stuff rather than sit down and work out words.
Yeah, I mean, give a dyslexic person the opportunity to write loads of stuff and you're going to get a story probably about a fish and the moon. and probably not much else. So... yeah, how we're going to do it is effectively I'm handing over the reins to Emily to be the person who asked me about the challenge. So it's over to you, really.
Yeah, perfect. Rules reversed. This reminds me a lot of when we used to do, I mean, I'm quite used to actually interviewing you for the videos that we usually do. I mean, even going back to the first 107, how many times did we sort of sit in either our little office or you'd come over to our house and we'd give you a bit of food and then I'd sit you down in front of a camera and just get you to talk.
We've done it a lot. I think you are the person that's interviewed me more than anyone else.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. And also why I like that is I think it always it's much more easier for me to talk to you than I mean, I'm pretty open anyway with chatting to people, but I find it I'm much more relaxed to chat to you than anyone else.
Yeah. And the best thing is this time you have to do the editing, not me, so that's fine.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, how much editing do I really do?
Cut off the start and the end and lob it up.
Yeah, press start. That sounds all right. Stop. I did a podcast, on a side note, I did a podcast with Monument Cycling, which is really, really nice one, but we recorded it. I only know when I recorded it because I looked back. I was talking about the last podcast I recorded, which was 7 episodes ago, and I'm talking about it in the podcast. And I really like their podcast, but I was just like, "Is there? How you getting on with that? It's been like a couple of months since we recorded it." And the guy is like, he's very much a perfectionist on making sure it sounds really good. And I was just like, and he sent me the audio file last night and was like, oh, I listened to it. Let me know what you think. And I was like, dude, you don't need to send it to me. You could have just uploaded it. It's fine. I'm pretty certain there's nothing that I would have wanted you to edit out or anything. Anyway, I listened to it at like about midnight last night. And I was like, yeah, I didn't even remember half the conversation.
I always find that I'm recorded. I like listen back afterwards. I'm like, I don't remember saying any of this.
Yeah. But I guess that's part of the nature of it, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway,
let's get into it. Right, so, Chris, I guess the first
Emily.
Question is, what is 107 all about?
So 107 is a number that's very connected to a children's school and charity called the PACE Centre. The reason why it's so connected is, so PACE is a school for kids with motor-based disorders, so things like cerebral palsy. The significance of the number is they historically and generally do still look after 107 kids. It's slightly changed since the secondary site has now opened, but to start with, they were 107 children in the school, which is a school for basically primary school age kids. The reason why it ended up being that number was that was purely the maximum amount of people they could look after, bearing in mind how staff heavy the school is, as well as obviously the limitations of space. As I said, this has slightly changed since they've opened a secondary site, but the secondary site is for newborns to like preschool age kids. So it's a slightly different offering, really, but that the secondary site is very much focused on trying to understand and recognise early cases of motor-based disorders, because it's very, very hard to diagnose that sort of thing in newborn kids. And the first 107 challenge actually helped a lot with getting that sort of secondary site off the ground, which was pretty awesome.
That is awesome. Yeah, because, I mean, I'm sure most people know, but obviously your connection with the PACE Centre goes back a good couple of years now to that first big challenge that you did, which was 107 for 107.
Yeah, I mean, that was hard, and I still think that was the hardest thing I've ever done. I don't think anything has quite compared to that yet. And I think what made it, like we were chatting just before recording, like how comparable is that to this project? And it's not really comparable. Like the distance is further, but you have to also bear in mind that it's over a much longer period of time. Mm. So the overall distance is much further, but the reason why I don't feel that it's comparable is the length of time it ran across. You know, we calculated at the end of that challenge, I did what, 12,500 kilometers or something crazy.
Something like that. I think it was even more than that, yeah.
Which is just a bonkers distance anyway, but you think that's over 3.5 months.
Yes.
The differences in the two challenges are quite extreme. And I mean, I don't think you can compare that original challenge to this, but you can compare Australia to this very well.
Yeah, it's different challenges, isn't it? Because over 3 months, you know, you set yourself a challenge of doing like just over 100 kilometers a day, which is difficult. But as with any sort of ultra event, it's the unplanned for things that can end up derailing them, isn't it? And over a longer space of time, ultimately, the chances of that happening are more, you know, like, for example, during that, you got very ill.
But, yeah, exactly.
But I guess also you had the luxury of, well, I don't know if you'd call it a luxury, but being able to go on the turbo for 6-7 hours or whatever it was and just kind of get it done. Whereas in this one, there's a lot less days. So I guess in that sense, there's less chance of things going wrong. But also, you know, you're out on the road on your own most of the time for a long time. You've got hills to contend with in different parts of the country. So yeah, it's very different, isn't it?
Yeah, there's still going to be a big element of, there's a lot of risk in it from being completely out on the roads. It's still, you know, it's riding effectively the three corners of the UK over 20 days, which is pretty crazy in its own right. One of the things with the original challenge was that I did the majority of the riding in London, which still in the winter is incredibly hard, but you're a bit more protected, and it always meant I was kind of close to home, or close to a friend's home, which meant that in the worst case scenario, I had somewhere I could go. While, you know, with this new challenge, it's kind of, you know, I'm riding a lot of roads I've never ridden before. So there's definitely still an element of the unknown, which is going to be interesting.
Absolutely,
to say the least.
Fun comes in.
yeah, exactly. It's still very exciting. I am apprehensive but excited.
Yeah. So let's talk about how does what you're doing now kind of tie into the Tour de France this year? Why is that the case?
So this year would have been the 107th edition of the Tour de France, or if it still happens, will be the 107th edition of the Tour de France. Like, I'm pretty sure it's going to happen. Like, we're less than 2 weeks away now. I can't see it being cancelled. And so a big thing for me was, and it always was, to work out a way of riding the Tour. Unfortunately, with the current global pandemic that we're in, I didn't think it was the right decision to travel to France to do this. I didn't feel particularly comfortable with the idea of it. And I spoke to a few friends and other brands that I work with to see what their opinion was on it as well. And it wasn't an easy decision to make, but I feel ultimately probably the right decision to focus on doing something in the UK that's still connected to the Tour, hence running this challenge during the same days as the 107th Tour de France.
Perfect. It's all come together quite nicely, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, it was touch and go for quite a long time as to whether I would go out to the Tour. And so my plan was to basically ride it nonstop. That plan got sort of stripped back and stripped back and stripped back. And then eventually I just sort of said, like, it's not worth the risk. But in the flip side, it's you know, when things don't go to plan like that, that also provides like a really good opportunity to be creative and think of something a bit different. And that's kind of how this idea came out, was going, what can I do still that supports a charity that's incredibly important to me, and has been incredibly important to me for several years now, but also fundamentally is safe for me and safe for other people as best as I can make it safe, with as kind of as minimal impact as I can on society, I guess. It's something that I have been very conscious in the planning is how to make it as kind of standoff as possible as I can. It's been interesting trying to dial that in, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if this year has been anything, it's been the year of kind of adaptation and just trying to keep life moving in the best way possible. But yeah, trying to have as little impact, not trying to, I guess, do any more harm than would be done otherwise. You know what I mean? It's trying to minimize your impact while still kind of keep it, you know, stopping the world from just stopping completely.
Exactly. And, you know, everyone's kind of in the same situation. You know, it's not just in the UK, it's international. It's a really strange time to be in, but make the best of the situation. As I said, like, it's an opportunity to, you know, be creative and try and think things a bit differently.
Absolutely. But I think I imagine, you know, for charities like Pace, this must have been a really, really difficult time for them because, you know, everything's retreated. You know, it seems like we're almost on the verge of a recession. People's money is potentially tighter because of, you know, whether it's feeling like job security is less or for whatever reason. So I imagine for the charity sector, it's hit them really, really hard. So from their perspective, they absolutely need campaigns like yours to keep them going and thriving because they've got kids that they need to look after and be able to support regardless of what else is going on, don't they?
Massively. I mean, yeah, I mean, you think of like mass participation, charity-focused events like, you know, the Ride 100, the London Marathon, you know, all the marathons, all the bicycle challenges around the country or even around the world, they've been cancelled. Those kind of challenges bring in a lot of money to charities. You know, you think of it in two ways, like all charities have to pay to have a place at those kind of events. But the flip side of paying for entries means that actually you do get a lot of people who choose to support the charities. It does balance out quite well. But because so many have been cancelled, there's just not really been the you know, the want or desire by a lot of people to directly fundraise for charities, unfortunately. I think it comes down to a lot of the instability of the current climate, and people just not necessarily, I think quite a lot of people just haven't realized that. They just haven't thought about it, in all honesty. So, you know, as all charities do still need to be functioning, they've still got bills to pay, they've still got causes to support. And one of the things for PACE is that, you know, they're very staff heavy and they're generally very, you know, it's very hands-on with the kids, which has obviously meant they've had to completely change the way that they educate and teach because they can't, you know, they can't do it in the same traditional way as they would do. And it's not just the, you know, that's not just hard for the kids, it's incredibly hard for the families. Because you, I know it almost sounds a selfish way of thinking about it, but the having the kids go to PACE is a break for the parents.
Absolutely.
And that's that, that in its own right is incredibly valuable. Because I mean, my connection with PACE is I've got friends that have kids there, and I can see and I understand the stress that it can cause them. So having that break is something that really does help. But yeah, charities are definitely across the world struggling more now than ever, probably ever in our lifetime, I would say.
Yeah. Which is why really something like this, which is a challenge that, you know, you're self-supported, you are taking the necessary steps to be as conscious of not, you know, cross-contaminating or anything like that. And it's a charity, it's a campaign that people can get behind predominantly online. So therefore, you know, it's kind of no risk involved in that sense, but actually exactly. Something people can get behind and get into the spirit of, and then, you know, it kind of draws attention to PACE and, you know, hopefully does some good for them as well. So in that sense, it's really, really good.
Yeah. I mean, fingers crossed it gets as much exposure as possible. Like the goal for everything that I've done, and I, as you all know, is it's never directly about the money that comes in, it's about the exposure, because subsequently through exposure, you know, people research and understand, and then quite often the money comes in. Because it can be that, you know, people are not necessarily in a situation or a position to be able to donate, and that's absolutely fine. Like I wouldn't want someone to put themselves in jeopardy in any way, sense or shape. Like if you're in a situation that you can, that's incredible. And the support is, you know, it's incredibly needed, and it's, you know, it's very thankful for the support. But on the, you know, there's other ways to get involved, and it's just things like educating yourself and being able to understand the kind of work that PACE do and how forefront thinking they are as a charity. Like they're of what they do and the research they do, they're probably one of the leading experts in Europe, I would say.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. Right, so let's delve into the challenge in a little bit more detail. So first of all, when does it start, and what are the rules?
So I'm starting on the same day as the 2020 Tour de France, which is the 29th of this month, so 29th of August. Nearly said April. I don't know why I always get August and April, but it's because they both begin with A, isn't it?
I think it's also because all of the months have just blended in together at this point, haven't they?
I mean, I don't even know I'm going to cancel the fact that I'm 30. I'm still 29. But yeah, so I'm starting the same day as the Tour de France, which is the 29th. The primary rule for me that I'm sticking to is that the distance is a minimum of 107 miles every day. The reason why I have to say a minimum is just logistically planning to be bang on that distance. Bearing in mind, like, trying to find places to stay and stuff it wasn't doable. So the minimum distance is 107 miles. And effectively what I'm doing is I'm riding the same days as the Tour de France. So the same rest days as they have in the Tour. But I've also, because at the end of the day, I'm not a pro. I'm still a normal guy. Like, I've given myself an additional rest day based on my own kind of experience, which I am treating it as the time trial stage in the Tour. So I've changed it because the Tour time trial stage is the second to last stage this year.
Yeah.
And to have that as a rest day to me is kind of, I see it as almost pointless. Sounds really weird to say, but
yeah, exactly. Something like 20K or 20 miles or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, and so what I've done is I've given myself a rest day 5 days in, which is I will treat that rest day as the time trial day. So I'll go out for a spin and effectively do that. But long and short of it, the main objective is to be riding when the tour is on, when it starts and when it finishes, and to hit 107 miles. Consequently, doing that across the UK means that I've ended up riding from London to Land's End, Land's End to John O'Groats, John O'Groats the long way back to London by hitting then the most easterly point of the UK, which is Lowes Croft. So, and then back into London. So I, on the route, I'm actually ticking off the most southern point of the UK, the most western point of the UK, the most northern point of the UK, and the most easterly point of the UK, which looks really cool when you see it on a map, actually.
It does. It does. I mean, I think this is the thing, you know, like Land's End to John O'Groats on its own is epic. And anyone who's sort of ridden that understands what an absolute feat it is of undertaking, you know. And as you say, when you actually look at the map, because you shared the route online now, and it just looks absolutely epic. So yeah, it's interesting to see what your sort of thinking was behind that, I guess, when putting it together. And you've been using Komoot, is that right, to put everything together on it?
Yeah, so Komoot, I like Komoot for route planning. I just think it's the additional information it provides is super useful. And also the way that you can then store all the routes as a collection. So yeah, it's all kind of in one place. It, like, aesthetically, is quite pleasing to look at. But it means that I can plan day one and then day two, day three, et cetera, et cetera. I can check out what my like estimated time is riding it. Like, I can see the elevation, the distance, make sure I actually do hit off that distance. So some of the days, for example, where I've been trying to find somewhere to stay, there's like bits where I've kind of like looped additional bits in just to tick off the distance, because it's trying to make sure that you find a place which you can stay, which is one, will allow you to bring a bike in, and two, being super strict on making sure that they're, you know, clean and ready for people traveling during the current climate we're in, and also to make sure that I'm hitting the distance. So like there's quite a lot of factors that come into it, but with Komoot it's being able to check on things like the road surfaces, knowing roughly the distances, knowing quite well the elevation, which is pretty scary on some days, actually. there's quite a few days that are well over 2,000 metres of climbing.
Only one thing I have noticed with Komoot, because we use it a lot as well, and we used it, we did like an extended coast-to-coast route a couple of years ago and used it for that, and it tends to underestimate the climbing just a little bit. Something just to bear in mind, because it can be quite soul destroying when you've already ticked over 2,000 meters and you're like, well, I'm still like 50k out, so I can't imagine it's going to be flat from here to home. But I mean, it tends to be, it'll give you definitely a good ballpoint. But hey, that's the UK as well, and especially up north, there is just no avoiding the hills.
It's the same down southwest, isn't it? You've got Dartmoor National Park.
That's true.
Yeah, so it's like I've not ridden. There's a lot of the UK I've never ridden, so I'm quite excited to see that. But I think everyone's in that situation. Like, there's so much of our country that we live in that we just don't know about. And so by that nature, there's going to be a lot of climbing. There's going to be a lot of, with Komoot, it generally tries to find the most sort of popular kind of routes and stuff, so yeah. Hopefully it should be some really beautiful bits of road, but we'll see how each day comes, and take it in my stride in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, this is it. It's really good for like cafe stops and stuff as well, because it tends to, if someone else has done that route, they can put in a little thing of like, I went to a cafe here and it was really nice. So it kind of
exactly,
like a little personal account of what someone else has done, which I find really useful.
But
it's interesting that you say that about kind of exploring the UK, because I definitely think that, you know, because holidays don't really seem to be as much of a thing this year, you know, for, I guess technically we can travel, but I think there's a lot of uncertainty, and especially with, you know, quarantines being imposed and that kind of thing, I think it's definitely put the idea of people exploring local a lot more on the agenda.
Definitely.
It's just kind of not something we do as much. I mean, you know, like when we both lived in London, obviously I'm not there anymore, like it always seemed the thing was, oh, we should just get a train out and go somewhere else. But actually, you don't end up doing it that much. You just kind of sort of forget about it. And I think really this year is, and perhaps just going forward as well, is just a much more time, a much better opportunity to kind of explore local routes and stuff more on your doorstep.
Yeah, and like, I mean, it does seem that, I think part of it that does make it tricky in the UK is like, from my experience, like I don't own a car, and trains are not the best for bikes at the moment. I'd like to think it will get better, but it's just not quite there. It's not quite right yet. It's not quite thought through. The moment, like, if you're like, there's no reason why you couldn't go somewhere and then go hiking, for example. That's very, very easy to do. Or if you have a car, you could drive to a different place and spend a weekend away. But if you don't own a car and you're, you know, going somewhere by bike, they just haven't quite dialed it in yet with the trains. It's so close.
No,
it's so,
right.
So close.
Just a
couple of little steps and it'll be it'll be amazing. And I'm only critical of it because of how, when I've traveled to Europe, how good it is. Like, it's just... I think in Europe, like, cycling's been more of a culture that's been driven into, you know, it's more part of their culture and part of their lifestyle. So I think it's just been kind of a bit more second nature. While in the UK, it's still like, cycling has obviously had another massive boom in the recent times, similar to how it had a massive boom in 2012. But it's just meant that we haven't quite got it right yet, which I think was always like a stumbling block for us when we were thinking about going out of London.
Yeah, I think you're right there. There's definitely work that needs to be done, isn't it? I'm kind of hopeful that, you know, there's obviously a lot of investment now being put into cycling infrastructure in cities, because ultimately they know that public transport just can't be what it has been previously in terms of numbers. And perhaps, hopefully, fingers crossed, the next stage is to think about, you know, for example, people who are coming in from Cambridge to London, who would usually, you know, get the train and then get the tube, is there a way that you can actually just make that train more cycling friendly so that when they get into London, they can then go on the rest of their journey by bike? Or, you know, the same for, like, if you're commuting into Manchester or Newcastle or wherever it is, just making cycling part of, like, a wider... I feel like all of these things are kind of spurred on by commuters in a sense, because they seem to dominate, you know, public transport so much more. It's easier to sort of see that sort of day-to-day need.
Yeah, definitely.
But just fingers crossed, hopefully it will get better.
It is getting better. It's just baby steps, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So when you don't think the train lines are quite good enough, just cycle the whole of the country.
Exactly, problem solved.
Yeah.
Right, so let's talk a little bit more about the logistics of how you actually do something like that, this, because inevitably they are just huge. So first of all, are you going to be supported at all, and where are you staying? Talk to me a little bit more about that kind of side of things.
So how I've planned this is basically, a lot of people have asked if I'm going to be like camping and stuff like that, and I made the decision quite early on that I wasn't going to camp, and there's a few reasons to it, and that is, one, it's more stuff to carry. If you compare this challenge to, say, when Francis and I rode across Australia, there's over 20,000 meters more climbing, which is a lot. So it's just additional weight, having to carry more stuff. That was a big part of it. I've done things like, for example, Atlas Mountain Race, where you carry all your camping gear, and it does really add additional weight to the bike. So my tactic has been researching hotels that have got a very good procedure in place for, like, contactless check-in, good, regular cleaning. Most of them are actually doing, like, most of them don't actually have their restaurants open, so they're only doing, like, meals which are basically contactless, delivered to your, like, room service effectively, but it's just put outside your room and you go and collect it, which I thought was quite interesting. In situations where I'm not staying at hotels, I'm staying with friends, and that's been a case of, like, purely to help with costs more than anything, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it adds up paying for hotels over a month, basically. And also a big part of that is a morale booster, is being able to see friends. I know I've tried to like load that towards the latter end of the challenge, because I know that's the kind of point where it will make a big difference, mentally and physically.
Absolutely. I think probably that's one of the advantages you have, having done 107 for 107 in the past, and I guess just doing more stuff and knowing yourself, I think, from having been involved with that, I know how much just kind of seeing a friendly face, or having a, you know, being able to come around for a meal at the end of the day or whatever it is, actually helps you a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm someone that's, you know, you've seen it firsthand, that kind of thing really is a big like boost for me, and can really help me if I know that I'm going to be struggling. And as I say, I've backloaded a lot of that towards the latter end of the trip, because I know that's the point I'll struggle. I've kind of done it tactically that I'm staying with friends 5 days in, and then I will be sort of seeing some friends about, I think, 7 or 8 days in as well. And then on the way back, it's sort of like the last like week is very much backloaded with opportunities where I'm passing near friends' houses or staying with friends, because that's where I'm pretty sure that I'm going to be a bit buggered and I could do with that. but I mean, yeah, the main logistics side of it is, you know, it does take a lot of time planning hotels. It's meaning that I have to be really strict with like the time that I'm leaving every morning, because a lot of hotels, for example, the check-in time is normally between 6 and 8 o'clock in the evening. Some there's a bit of flexibility with some, but generally speaking, it's quite strict. So, you know, I'm leaving every morning early. I know what time I've got to get to the finished destination, and there's not really much I can change about that. It's kind of set in stone. That's what has to be done. If I don't get to that hotel, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do. Like,
yeah,
find another hotel and kind of hope.
That is kind of the nature of point to point type stuff, isn't it? That you, I mean, number one, there's that. There's just like logistics you have to meet, and therefore you have to be doing a certain time. But I think also the thing that you know from having done stuff like this before is, the slower you go, the more time you're on the bike. Therefore, the less time you have to have your dinner, have a shower, get to bed, all of that kind of wind down stuff that is as important as actually being on the bike as well. So where going slow has its merits in some cases, it's actually you have to, I guess, have a benchmark in mind of what you need to be doing each day and what time that's going to take, right?
Yeah, there's a very, very, very fine line between too slow and too fast. Mm. Too fast and you're doing detrimental damage that you're going to feel it the next day, or maybe not the next day, but the next 2 or 3 days. Too slow, the flip side of it is you're reducing your recovery time, and that the recovery time is probably the most important thing. And as you said, it's the winding down. It's not just the stopping, because like I find, and probably anyone who's done anything kind of similar will be in the same situation, that you find that you end up spending like an hour or two not really switching off after these kind of things.
Yeah.
And then by the time you get into bed, you might not just fall asleep straight away. So the sooner, effectively, the earlier I can finish each day, the better, because that's feet up, get some food and rest. I'm quite good at being able to do that and forcing myself to do that. And that's, you know, it's pretty fundamental to the challenge that I stick to those kind of deadlines, because it can lay detriment to so much further down the line, where I have to then end up maybe riding harder to try and get somewhere because I'm running out of time.
Yeah, this is it. And I mean, I noticed from having a look at your social media, a lot of people are interested in actually sort of coming along and sort of giving you a little bit of support on the route. So how is that kind of side of things going to work, or how do you hope that will go?
I mean, it's pretty crazy how many people have like messaged and asked if they can like ride, and like by all means, like I'd love people to come out, whether that's a ride to ride with me for a bit, or whether it's like just just literally standing at the side of the road and saying hi, like those kind of things, it makes a lot of difference to your like mental state anyway. Mm. And also having someone to chat to when you're riding. Like I'm doing this on my own, so I'm going into it not expecting to ride with anyone. So any opportunities where there is people is a great boost. But like I think I had to like put the expectations out there very much from the start that like, yes, you're more than welcome to, but also I have to go at a certain pace that I know I can sustain. So whether that is too fast or too slow for you, there's not much I can do about that. The bigger thing is completing the challenge, not riding with people. Like as selfish as that might sound, it's the fundamental thing is the cause for the challenge and continually referring back that this is an opportunity to get exposure for an incredible charity. But equally, having a wheel to sit on or a person to talk to for even if it's like half an hour, that is incredibly valuable, probably much more than people realize. In fact, yeah, 100% much more than people realize or understand. Like it does make a big difference. It's a distraction at the end of the day. Yeah. Which is, if you're starting to ache, that distraction is worth its weight in gold.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I know it's quite difficult to put, for example, average speed on it because it just completely depends on the day and the amount of elevation that day and what you're aiming for. But you kind of said earlier that potentially it's like 7 to 8 hours depending on the distance and elevation that day.
Yeah, I mean, in my head, that's what I'm kind of thinking is between seven. Well, I'd say 7 to 9 hours, really. Right. But I'd prefer it to be within 7 to 8 hours.
Yeah.
As you said, elevation comes into it. Headwinds, you know, wind speed, that kind of stuff comes into it. Weather comes into it. Like it all can change and skew that very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. But my head is saying if I could do it between 7 and 8 hours, that'd be pretty spot on.
Per day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously there's going to be a lot of people listening, following along who aren't going to be able to ride with you because either, you know, they can't do that or they're in a different location, they're all over the world. So for those who can't ride with you, how can they follow along and how is it going to be documented?
So the first thing to say is all going to plan, there will be a live tracker on my website. It's kind of built. We just need to make sure it's all working and wait for the actual tracker to turn up, which is slightly worrying, but it should be here like imminently. So I wanted to do a live tracker because it allows people to see very clearly where I am at different points, and it's quite interesting. People like dot watching, and I mean I find it fascinating anyway, so that's like one of the fundamental first things. Secondly, obviously my social media accounts, I'm going to be doing Instagram stories all the time, posting as and when as much as I can about how things are going, how it's all kind of, if it's going well or going shit. And thirdly, hopefully I can make it work, but and it'll very much come down to how I physically am feeling. I'm sort of planning to try and record a summary podcast, so to speak, every evening on how the day went. They won't be anywhere like some of the previous podcasts. It'll be more like a 20-minute sort of download of the situation. This mm-hmm. is what's happened during the day, very unedited, basically a voice memo on my phone. But it gives a good opportunity for people who maybe don't log into other social media accounts to just listen to it as well. That's my take on it anyway. And then when I'm riding and meeting with, you know, riding along and seeing friends and stuff, people are obviously, I'd imagine, I can't obviously don't know, but I'd imagine a lot of people are going to be posting and tagging and sharing, which will help get as much exposure to it as well. And then the final one, which is pretty cool, is my bike sponsor, Cervelo, who have been 100% behind this since I first said it, like you guys at Atticus as well, who, you know, you guys have supported me with everything I've done. And Cervelo are relatively new to the four as a relationship, but they've been 100% behind everything that I've wanted to do and I'm wanting to do in the future. And as part of that, they they're intending to make a short documentary about it, which is pretty cool. And how that will be is effectively there's a videographer or a couple of videographers who will be in a car and will basically appear at certain points on the route. The advantage of that, like, for me, is that I'm very openly, I'm going to leave a bag of emergency spares with them in a car in the situation that I need it. Similarly, I'm going to post a bag of emergency spares to friends that I'm staying with, so that if there's anything I need en route, I've got it already kind of covered. But, you know, being in the UK, I'm quite lucky that there's a lot of bike shops and there's a lot of places where I should be able to get stuff. But yeah, the Cervelo one should be pretty cool. They're kind of planning to help push it and sort of drive as much exposure towards PACE to try and help get as much support for the charity as well, which is pretty amazing of a brand of that caliber. I was quite flattered that they really got behind it. Actually, I wasn't expecting it, but you know, it kind of catches you off guard a bit still.
Yeah, I think that's fab. I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about it yesterday, and like the one of the key things was like, make sure that, you know, it needs to be as real as possible as well, so that people can really understand that it's not going to be a walk in the park. It's not going to be easy, and I'm kind of at peace with that. I know it's going to hurt, and I know that it's going to be tough. Like, I've never ridden Land's End to John O'Groats, but I know lots of people who have and have said that it's very hard. And I also know that very, very few people then decide to cycle back because it's normally a headwind. So there's a lot of being able to see this challenge documented in that way will hopefully drive support towards PACE. And also, like, it becomes a really lovely memory for me in a selfish way as well. Like, I'm very lucky to have so many friends who work in video, whether that's YouTube or whatever it is, that I'm very lucky that so many of these challenges I've done have been documented that I can go back and look back at them. It's quite a special thing to me, actually.
Absolutely. And of course, we've noticed that you are coming back down via the northeast and will be coming in pretty close to where base now. So we'll be able to meet up with you, and possibly a Mr. Francis Cade also will be along for a little section of the route as well. So
if he's not too busy eating bread and drinking Coca-Cola, I'd imagine.
That's it.
Life of a rock star that guy has now. Bread, Coca-Cola, hummus, vegan pizza.
Everything you need for a long distance ride.
Yeah, exactly.
And you mentioned it briefly before, but in terms of the distance and elevation, we were talking about it before and just what challenge that you've already done that is closely comparable. And it sounds like Australia is the closest one, because if I'm right in saying it's the same number of days.
Yeah, so Australia was 20 days. This is also 20 days. Australia distance towards the end was 3,763 kilometers. This one will be 3,598. Obviously, this is the plan, so it might change during the riding. Yeah. And while the Australia is actually the scores on the door, so to speak. Australia, the duration of Australia was 150 hours and 3 minutes. The plan for this one on paper is 166 hours and 59 minutes. It should have just said 167 there, really. Then the big difference, so the rest of that's kind of quite similar. The big difference is the elevation. Australia was 15,000 meters, just over 15,000. Well, this is just over 35,000 meters.
Wow. So over double.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if I'm not naturally a climber, I might become a climber by the end of this. We'll see. Yeah,
how are you feeling about that?
I don't mind going uphill. I mean, I've been doing like 20 rep challenges of Swain's Lane recently, so yeah. I don't mind it. Part of that is bits that I'm changing on the bike, because I would normally ride like a 53-39 chainring on the front on a road bike. I'm 100% dropping that down. I'm putting a semi-compact on it and then riding an 11-30 cassette, because I normally would never ride that kind of ratio, but it just gives me that bit of extra gearing to kind of deal with it a bit better.
This is it. Save your knees in any way you can.
Exactly. You know, I'm riding 28 tires because they're big, fat and comfy. I am doing it on a road bike. I am also using like 50 mil carbon rims because of aero. Any aero gains, I'm going to take advantage of that.
Absolutely. Especially when you go into a headwind. Like, this is the thing, because you had a lot of headwind. I mean, basically exclusively headwind on in Australia. But it's kind of, I tend to find, you know, in our little pocket of the north, it seems to be exactly the same. It's just constant headwind. You turn a corner, you're like, okay, we'll get the tailwind now, and it just somehow continues. So
yeah, it does. As I said previously, it does tend that traditionally riding from Land's End to John O'Groats is quite often a tail or a cross tail, and then if you were to do it the opposite way around, obviously it's a head or cross headwind. So we'll see. That's the second half of the trip coming back. So we'll see how that goes during it.
So anyone that's large and can provide a good draft can be recruited on that second half.
Oh, 100%. If you're like 6 foot plus, you'd be great. But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm riding on a road bike. I'm riding on my R3, my Cervelo R3, which is pretty tried and tested by me now. I like the bike. I find it super comfortable. It's the first kind of bike that I rode after the Atlas Mountains and trying to recover from my injuries after that, which was, you know, fundamentally was to do with my back. I'd be honest, I put my hands up, I was concerned that it might be too stiff. But actually, having used it, like after the injuries while I was recovering, I was really pleasantly surprised at how comfortable it is. And that's what Cervelo have always said about the R3, is that they do the R3's now been branded as the R series. They've just done like a rebrand of all their stuff. So you have the R series and the R5, both awesome bikes, but the main differences are that the R series is slightly more relaxed, slightly less aggressive, so it has like a longer head tube, and it also is designed to be a bit more comfortable. And so that's why, like, the R3 or the R series, if you look traditionally in the past, that the pro teams that Cervelo has sponsored, that's the bike they'd ride like Flanders and Roubaix on, because it is a bit more comfortable and a bit more compliant. But yeah, I'm going to be riding that, clip-on bars on it. I've got DI2 buttons on the ends of the clip-on bars. I'm just waiting for some new DI2 cables because I can't find any anywhere. So I'm waiting for some new ones to put in. Running Ultegra DI2 on it. Parkour's 50 mil carbon rims. I do have a dynamo hub on the front wheel, but I don't think I'm going to set it up. I think I'm going to just carry some rechargeable lights because I don't need to rely on a dynamo, which I would do, say, in, you know, Atlas Mountains or Kyrgyzstan. I didn't take a dynamo light with me for Australia, but I took a very, very strong front light, same strong rear lights. The tactic at the moment with like luggage is to use tail fin on the back. I just think it's the best rear pack I've used. Like, no qualms about that. I just think it's really, really good, because it's stable, and also sits really well, like, behind you. Like, it just feels nice to ride with.
They're good, aren't they? This is almost the problem with bike bags sometimes, is that it just gets in the way. It almost like changes the way you ride because they're like rubbing in some way, whereas anything like pannier style is kind of perfect because it's just never compromising the way you're riding on your bike, is it?
Yeah, and the one I'm using is the aero pack, which just sits right behind you on the top. It's great. Like, it's proper spot on. And then I think I'm just going to take a frame bag as well. I've got like a few different frame bags to choose from. I haven't quite figured out what one I'm going to choose from yet, but I'm effectively whatever one fits nicest inside the bike frame will be the one that I end up going for. I'm steering towards not having a front like bar bag on because they do just become, it could be a hindrance to have. And a lot of the big front bar bags, quite often I don't have flared bars on the R3, and quite often the problem with the larger bar bags, if you don't have a flared bar, is that you can't like get on the drops or hold the hoods nicely. So
yeah,
a lot of my head's kind of saying like, if I don't need it, I'm not going to take it. It's an additional weight, and it's kind of, it could end up becoming an excuse to take more that I don't need.
This is, isn't it? Yeah, I think I'm definitely guilty of that in all circumstances. I pack however big the bag I have allows me to, where actually really you need to be almost analyzing everything that you're putting in, and do you need to be carrying that round for a day, especially when you're entering the hilly sections. It's just extra weight, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and I feel like I've gained enough experience in the past from overpacking and underpacking for events. I kind of know what to take. I'm planning on obviously taking some brand new Atticus bib shorts I haven't even worn yet. Two pairs of them, because I'm saving them for best. And I think this is a good excuse for best, isn't it?
Yes.
And then a couple of jerseys, probably one of the like long sleeve jackets, gilet, arm warmers, leg warmers, all that kind of stuff. I probably won't take knee warmers. I normally wouldn't. I just do arm warmers and leg warmers.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, this is probably the hardest challenge, isn't it? The good old British weather. I mean, who knows what it's going to be like in September?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I'm looking at my flat right now and it hasn't stopped raining this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tricky on the sense of knowing roughly what to pack. I'm going to take like some light casual clothes just for downtime in the hotel. It'd be very similar tactic to Australia. It's like you have two sets of kits, wash it after the ride, wear the clean kit the next day. Hope that it's kind of dry than it as well. Like, but to be honest, you can like dry a kit quite quickly with a hairdryer, worst case scenario.
Yes. Or you've got, is it you that has like the towel technique where you sort of, you scrunch it up in the towel and then stand on it?
Yeah. Yeah. The towel techers. Roll it up in the towel, wring it out, and then stamp on it loads. And it just gets as much of the water out as possible as well, yeah. Which is really, really helpful.
That's especially good for the chamois in shorts, I would say as well. Cause that's always the thing that takes the longest to dry, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, you know, I'm going to take a big down jacket because they're so lightweight and also so warm.
Yeah.
Right, they make a massive difference.
I mean, your rest days and that kind of thing, you're gonna want something that's just like an extra layer.
Yeah.
Or you could just walk around Edinburgh in Lycra and leg warmers.
Yeah, I mean, that would go down well, wouldn't it? The one debate I always have, and it is a problem I always have with any of these kind of challenges, is footwear.
Yeah.
So because I've got flipper feet, that's where the problem is that I still haven't decided yet really what shoes to take, whether I take mountain bike shoes because you can kind of walk in them, or I take my road shoes with... and then like a pair of flip-flops. That'll come down to when I'm like finalizing how much what room I've got. My preference is probably to go road shoes because better power transfer, they're lighter, and I feel like personally they just feel proper dialed in, like, yeah. They're really comfortable. But you know, we'll see. If I can't fit some flip-flops, it'll probably end up being mountain bike shoes.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that, because I remember on Francis's Double Everest, when he was inside, he wore like MTB type pedals for that. And we asked him about that, and he just said, oh, just because it's easier to walk in when he's getting on and off the bike. And it wouldn't even occur to me. I would always, if I was on my road bike, just wear, you know, I wear speed play, but I would always think of doing that. I wouldn't even think about what would be more comfortable off the bike. Is it, I don't know, it's hard, isn't it? Because it's still not really that comfortable to walk in cycling shoes, even like, you know, like gravel type shoes or whatever. I never find it that comfortable. And then you're compromising off the bike and then compromising on the bike as well. However, it means that you're saving the weight on a pair of shoes.
Exactly. Like, but then is the toss up is like a pair of like flip flops weigh so little anyway.
They do.
It's the toss up of going, does it really like, is it much of, is the difference between taking a pair of mountain bike shoes and flip flops? And or a pair of road shoes and flip-flops, like, is it actually any lighter just taking one pair of shoes? I doubt there's much in it. It's probably more, it is the space saving is the thing more than anything.
I tell you what, wearing flip-flops if you get caught in the rain is an absolute nightmare because you end up sliding all over them.
Exactly I mean,
socks and flip-flops, taking that look, that would work.
Yeah, socks and flip-flops is a strong look as well, isn't it? I mean, Australia, I took a pair of like Vans, just like slip-on Vans.
Yeah.
Which was okay, but they take up loads of room. Like I've got big feet, so whatever shoes I take, they take up the length of the tail fin.
Yeah.
Like they're the length of it. So normally when I pack, it's like I put them at the bottom, like flat. Or I put them on the sides as like ballasts on the sides. It's one or the other. It depends what mood I'm in. But like Atlas Mountains, didn't take any other shoes, but I did it all in mountain bike shoes. So I only wore mountain bike shoes. So it does. I'll be like refining my kind of like packing list of stuff over this weekend. So yeah, it'd be interesting. Which in that note means that I need to actually order some flip-flops because I don't think I have any. So...
I tell you what someone needs to invent. So I've seen these things before. I can't remember whether they're like for festivals or nights out or maybe both, but you basically get like women's, like, I think they call them like dolly shoes or like ballet pumps, but they're like just really easy, like slip-on shoes. And someone invented them where they like basically roll up in a ball and they're like tiny, tiny shoes. And one of the things, people used to take them in uni in their bags so that, you know, when you'd spent a night in your heels and you, rather than like doing a walk home, in bare feet, which a lot of people used to do in my uni, you'd take these little like ballet shoes out and you'd put them on as well, but they like curl up so tight. So number one, someone needs to invent, I mean, maybe just get some of those. They're quite feminine, but I think you could rock it. I don't know if they come in size 12 or 13 or whatever size your feet are, but someone needs to invent those and market them to cyclists because I think there's something there.
There really is something in there for like a good packable shoe, because I can't find anything at the moment. And I don't know whether that's me just being flipper foot size that seems to be tricky. Probably is, in all honesty, but it's one of those things that hasn't quite been figured out. I don't think it's so bad if you have smaller feet. It definitely is a big problem if you have flipper feet.
Yeah,
really is.
What we've always done in the past is kind of taken just a really, really lightweight flip-flop and end up almost like hooking them onto the outside of the bike bag, because I find this, I mean, I'm only size 5 feet, but I find just the room that they take up in your bike bag is just like, it just seems crazy. So we always strap them to the outside, but then you almost get like a bit of a like a flappy issue, so it's probably not great for aerodynamics.
Yeah, exactly. It's always a weird one. Always weird. There's got to be... There will be a solution. I just don't know what it is. The thing with the tail fin as well, because of how the straps are on it, because the top's a roll top and then the straps kind of go around it, you could actually put flip-flops between the straps and the roll top.
Yes.
They're going to sit pretty compact.
Yeah.
Pardon? I think that should work.
Do you do that?
Yeah.
Oh, he's got his headphones in. He's not listening. I'm pretty sure he does that as well. Like, hooks it in between the, straps.
Like, that would be a logical way of doing it. I am kind of swaying towards a set of flip-flops because I can't really see me on my rest days wanting to go and do much walking, apart from probably to a shop or a coffee shop or something, just to buy some supplies.
Yeah.
But I think flip-flops are probably the way forward, and road shoes. As I said, like, I just feel like my road shoes are proper. They feel good now. Like, I really struggle with shoes. Like, I struggle with the shoes I wear, which is Shimano S-Fire ones, are the best that I've found. But previously, I've tried so many different brands and I just never quite found the right one. And I think what's helped is you know, I spend a lot of time with Tim, who's my bike fitter, and he, I suffer quite badly from tendonitis, and Tim, in his wisdom, figured out this solution that just seems to work. And it's, you know, it's meant, like, with, for example, with the National 24s, I've been able to do them because it doesn't seem to cause the tendonitis to flare up. And it's basically, I have custom insoles anyway, but on top of that, we attach a metatarsal pad to the base of them, which basically what that does with how my tendonitis flares up quite often is I effectively like claw my toes, which causes tension in the tendons and then causes it to flare up and become ridiculously painful. But these metatarsal pads, because they push in the base of your foot, it stops my toes like clawing, and therefore relieves the pressure, and therefore I don't tend to get the tendonitis flaring up. I have them in my mountain bike and my road shoes, but they, like, at the moment, like, it just feels like proper good, really good.
I guess these are the things that you you get dialed in over lots of years of doing stuff like this, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Mm. It takes a lot of practice and experience, and just kind of knowing your own body. It's the same thing of like knowing how to pace this sort of thing. I'm now, I think I'm quite lucky that I'm in a situation I've done a fair few similar things that I kind of know what to expect, and I know it's gonna hurt. Like, I know there's gonna be shit days, there's gonna be days where I've just got no energy, there's gonna be days where all I want to do is eat jelly snakes, there's gonna be days where I probably don't want to eat a thing, and it's gonna be highs, there's gonna be you know, the contrasting incredible highs to incredible lows. That's the nature of doing multi-day things when you're you know, you accumulate so much fatigue and stress into it. But a lot of this is all things that, you know, I know how to cope with, and my coach Ken is one of my like closest mates, and we spend a lot of time sort of talking through that side of it as well, on the mental aspects as well as the physical aspects of how to do it. And Ken's very good at like getting me in a good headspace for it, and equally yourself and Jimmy are really good at that as well for me. I always say Jimmy knows it, and I think he plays on it a lot. I think he knows it and is using it against me somehow. A lot of the long distance, like especially the National 24, I would never do that race without Jimmy.
Yeah, I think again it just comes down to, you know, in as much as you learn something every time you do something like this, also the people around you learn something about how to support you in that way as well.
Yeah, I'm so lucky to have the group of friends that I do, who have always got behind everything I've done. I don't think people realize how much that means to me. I really don't. It's fundamental to how I manage to do a lot of the things I do. It's so, so important. You're all good people.
It's great. And I mean, from our perspective, it's a lot easier to be on our side than on your side.
Damn it.
But no, it's all good. Is there anything else that you want to say before we start to wrap things up? I've been drinking a pint of coffee and a pint of orange squash, and I am feeling it now, so I'm going to have to...
Do you know what? I've had one coffee this morning, which is not a lot for me. And I've done it purely because I know in the past where I'm like, at the end, I'm cross-legged.
It's the learning from experience thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess the main thing is like, for me, the main things I just want to say is like, thank you so much to everyone already who has, you know, messaged, commented, called me, texted me, donated, taking the piss out of me, whatever it is, it all means a hell of a lot. And I'm already quite surprised, actually, that there's been quite a few donations. I haven't even started yet. And that's it's a really nice little motivation boost. And on that note, donation page is live and open. And if you go to, I'll put a link in the description for this podcast, but it is just literally crystalrise.com/107TDF. And there's, if you scroll down, there's a big button in the middle of the page that says donate to Pace. So as I said earlier, if you can support, it's incredibly thankful, and it means a hell of a lot to me, to my friends who have supported everything I've done, and also to the Pace Centre fundamentally. But I, you know, by all means, if you, the key word there is if you can support, it's incredibly appreciated. If not, hopefully see some people on the road. If not, follow along and let's have a fun, jolly old ride across the UK.
Lovely. No, I'm looking forward to it, man. I hope it all goes really, really well for you, and we'll catch up with you, if not beforehand, on the northeastern leg on the way back.
Yeah, yeah. Did we say, I can't even remember what day we said that was, like sometime towards, it's like last 5 or 6 days, isn't it?
Yeah, when
15th, 16th of September, sometime around then.
Correct, yes. Day 15, the 15th. You're very close to our neck of the woods, so yeah, we'll catch up then.
Nice casual 200k day that day.
Perfect. I think I'll send Jimmy out to meet you, and I will probably I'll wait with a cup of tea at the end.
Amazing. I'm gonna take the reins back off you now, because I know you need to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
Thank you so much to Emily for effectively swapping roles with me on this episode. Hopefully that kind of answers tons of people's questions in the challenge. Obviously, if there's any more questions, send me a message on any of my social media accounts, whether that's my personal one, Crystal Rides, or the Zero Lemon account, and I'll endeavour to reply to you as quick as I can. I've been really inundated, so apologies if there's a delay in getting back to you at any point, but I'm trying to get back to everyone as much as I can. But yeah, we'll hopefully aim to do another sort of catch-up podcast similar to this post-challenge, talking about a bit of a debrief. So yeah, thank you so much, Emily. You yeah, legend.
I'm up for that. Let's do it.
Yeah. Have a good rest of your day. Thank you.
Thanks, mate. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.